This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I'm going to keep on saying this until certain people start hearing it. Stocks go down too, y'all, because that's the way it works. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 17th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There were a whole bunch of things that conspired today to give traders a small to medium-sized case of the willies. Barcelona and that horrible attack today, for one. Politics here, for another. What's going on in the White House? Who might be leaving? Who would be left behind? Also, along those lines, another, one can only say, remarkably candid interview from a Trump administration official. The Call a Random reporter up in Vent, White House staffer in question this time, was the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, who said, among many other, again, remarkable things, quote, "We're at economic war with China, and it's a war that Bannon seems to think the United States is losing." So we sent Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson off to look at the once and future state of bilateral economic affairs.
To say that we're at war with another country, economic or otherwise, sure gets people's attention. But rhetoric aside, the Trump administration has a point, says Nick Consonary, director of Asia political risk at FTI Consulting.
There is a broad sense in the business community, and I think on both sides of the political aisle in the U.S., that, you know, the economic and business relationship with China does need to be improved.
Consonary says the U.S.-China relationship is competitive and cooperative, but generally China benefits more than the U.S. Ishwar Prasad is a trade policy professor at Cornell.
China has not kept to all its commitments to open up its markets to U.S. products, to U.S. investment, and more generally for U.S. businesses to operate more freely in China.
But economic war?
I think Bannon exaggerates the cataclysmic nature of this clash.
Derek Scissors is an Asia economist at the American Enterprise Institute. He says the U.S.-China relationship isn't falling off the rails and China's not taking over the world. But if Bannon gets his way, we don't know whether China will change its ways. It might. Or here's Derek Scissors again.
We could have threats of Chinese retaliation or actual Chinese retaliation against American farmers. They could retaliate against Boeing, against Apple, you know, you name it.
He says with a Chinese political transition looming in the fall, the timing is complicated. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, so among all the nervousness-inducing political and economic news, there is actually some reassuring data on climate change to tell you about. The United States has, over the past decade, reduced its emissions of carbon dioxide. That much we knew, but there is some fresh analysis out about how we did it and what future decarbonization, which I'm told is the word, is going to look like. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Scott Tong.
U.S. emissions have fallen 14% since 2005, according to Carbon Brief, a London-based science and policy group. The main reasons? Well, imagine a shared podium of winners. One is natural gas from fracking, displacing coal in the making of electricity. Carbon Brief analyst Zeke Hausfather says the U.S. has plenty of gas.
There's no expectation that the supply is going to dry up anytime soon. And prices are so cheap right now, they're outcompeting coal. And we'd expect that to continue.
Wind energy is another champion. As are factories using less power, as are more efficient gasoline cars. That's today. But emerging technologies mean the future winners could look a lot different. James Newcomb at the Rocky Mountain Institute think tank figures batteries will play a much bigger role, say if India succeeds in its goal to sell only electric cars by 2030.
That scale would require about 40 Tesla-scale gigafactories. And that's where we start to think about the analogy to Moore's Law, of very rapidly increasing global production.
That is exponential growth in electric vehicles, the same way transistors and computer chips grew. Doug Vine at the nonprofit Center for Climate and Energy Solutions says the next big steps to a low-carbon future are a ways off, but he sees them.
We need to decarbonize the power sector to the greatest extent possible. And then the next step is to start using more electricity in the other sectors.
Not just more electric cars, but even electric industrial furnaces. Vine says it all starts with green electricity. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, Wawa Trombones is where my money is, but I don't get to pick. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've been paying attention to some of the president's recent public remarks, you might have noticed something besides all that stuff. He leads often with the economy or the stock market or his economic agenda and how great it's going to be. He did the same thing on Tuesday during that amazing press conference in New York, ostensibly about infrastructure, but really about Charlottesville and race and cultural relations in this country. Here's what I'm talking about.
We have many companies, I say, pouring back into the country. I think that's going to have a huge positive impact on race relations. You know why? It's jobs. What people want now, they want jobs. They want great jobs with good pay. And when they have that, you watch how race relations will be.
We're going to explore that a little bit. Dorothy Brown is professor of law at Emory University, where she teaches, among other things, race theory and tax policy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you heard the president there. Do you believe that good jobs are going to fix race relations in this country?
Here's the problem. The research shows us that even when you are a black graduate with a Harvard degree, you are treated not as well as white graduates with a Harvard degree. There is research that talked about the number of employer responses, and they found that far more blacks needed to apply to far more jobs in order to get responses from employers than whites did. So the private sector employers are not colorblind when they hire. And the study also showed, specifically getting back to the point that Trump made, that the jobs that the black graduates were offered were less prestigious and lower pay.
Broaden it out for me then to the rest of the president's proposed economic agenda, which is still working its way through Congress. Things like tax reform and infrastructure policy. Do you believe that the president's economic agenda will contribute to better race relations in this country?
Well, no, because I don't think at this point anything that the president would put forward would be well received. So when you're defending neo-Nazis as good people, it's really hard for someone to take any policy proposal you have seriously or to believe you are implementing them with the goal of assisting race relations.
So with race-based income and wage inequality in this country being what it is, which is enormous,
yes,
with the current political environment that we have, in part thanks to Tuesday, but certainly it goes beyond that, what policies then could be helpful in that regard?
So I look a lot at the racial implications of tax policy, and one of the things I found is when blacks and whites engage in the same behavior, blacks wind up paying higher taxes than whites. I found it when blacks get married. You can look at it also with respect to homeownership. Tax reform that minimizes or eliminates loopholes, tax reform that would get us back to individual taxation and not have marriage either give us a tax cut or a tax raise would help minimize the racial gap, in my view.
Yeah, you mentioned home ownership. I mean, there is, of course, the home ownership, the home mortgage interest tax deduction. And when you look at the number of blacks in this country who own homes versus the number of whites, right there, there's a great disparity.
There's a great disparity. And then when you look at black homeowners compared with white homeowners, the biggest tax break is not the mortgage interest deduction. It's the fact that if you're married, you can receive up to $500,000 of gain on your sale of your home tax-free. Since white homeowners are living in homes that are more highly valued – and that appreciate more than blacks. Numerous studies have shown this. White homeowners are the ones that are going to benefit the most from that tax break, not black homeowners.
Yeah, and we should say here, just in this, in terms of actual household wealth and ability to progress economically in this country, blacks are at a structural disadvantage that there is no amount of single-term president or two-term president is going to be able to fix.
Absolutely. It took us, you know, over a couple hundred years to get here. It's going to take massive commitment to even have the conversation, but certainly not one term. It didn't go away in President Obama's two terms either.
Dorothy Brown, she's a professor of law at the Emory University School of Law. Professor Brown, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I gave a quick nod to the president's infrastructure announcement a minute ago. His plan to cut red tape quickly got lost in the shuffle because of the other stuff that he said. Also, today the president abandoned plans for an advisory council on infrastructure. But it is worth remembering that Trump ran and won on a promise of a $1 trillion plan to repair and rebuild our bridges and roads and transit systems and all the other ways that this economy moves itself around. Now, though, 7 months, one infrastructure week, and a couple of executive orders later, plans is still all we got. So today we're going back to Erie, Pennsylvania, and our series, The Big Promise, where Marketplace's Erica Barris has this story of infrastructure and what it can mean for economic progress.
Rhonda Glover is between jobs as a home health care aide. For weeks, she's been talking with different companies. Usually things are going well, until...
They asked me, what is my transportation method? When I say bus, it ends the interview. So there is no getting around it.
She says that's because employers would rather not depend on someone who depends on the bus.
If you miss one bus, you have to wait 45 minutes for the next bus. So no, it doesn't work.
And that makes it hard for Glover to work. She's a single mom who lives with her 6 young kids on Erie's east side. Nearly all the jobs close to her either pay minimum wage, just over $7 an hour, or require skills she doesn't have.
Most new job growth is outside the neighborhood, often outside the city.
That's Gary Horton, head of Erie's NAACP. He's talking about the types of work, like home health care or child care, where people like Glover could earn a few dollars more an hour.
And if you don't have accessible public transportation and you don't own a car, then you're effectively prevented from experiencing any opportunity that may be there.
Horton also runs the Quality of Life Learning Center in Harbor Homes. It's a sprawling public housing project sandwiched between two corridors of what used to be bustling industry. Most of the nearly 500 families who live there, including Glover's, are black and poor.
A large number of single-parent households. There's a large number of children. There are probably few working men and women who live here. 60% of the people do not own a car. It's pretty bleak.
In fact, nearly half of all blacks who live in Erie are below the poverty line. And unreliable transportation, says Horton, helps keep them there. Before the big exodus to the suburbs, Michael Tan, who runs the Erie Metropolitan Transit Authority, says...
Everybody lived in the city of Erie, mostly, and everybody worked in the city of Erie, mostly, and everybody shopped in the city of Erie, mostly.
And the transit system got people where they needed to go easily. But as it stretched into the suburbs, state and federal funds didn't stretch enough with it. So a bus line that once covered a 30-minute loop now makes a much longer one. And low-income people are more dependent on the buses than ever, even for the most basic things. When Rhonda Glover wants fresh food, she gets on a bus that goes straight to the front door of a supermarket. And when she comes back... It's
6 bags on one arm, 6 bags on the other arm, and 3 bags in each hand.
And her timing has to be right. If she gets stuck at the checkout line, she's stuck with melting ice cream and warm milk because she missed the bus. Today, Glover is getting a bit of a break from Erie's transit system. She's answering phones at the Quality of Life Learning Center, not far from her apartment. Community service is required for her to receive cash assistance from the state. Glover takes a break from her duties to talk to Patrice Johnson, a housing case manager. Johnson grew up poor in Erie. Now she helps people move out of public housing by helping them find decent paying jobs. And yes, that starts with the bus line.
I make sure that it would be on that bus line, or it wouldn't be too far from that bus line. If they have to walk a block or two to get to that bus line, I understand that. But walking 7, 8, 10, 12 blocks.
Even today, the bus isn't too far from Glover's mind. She ends her shift a few minutes early so she can catch a bus across town to pick up her kids.
Right on time. Look at that.
What?
They've spent the day at Grandma's.
Stop. See that? This is how the traffic is. People don't care or watch for pedestrians.
Look, the bus is on time. Woo!
In a couple weeks, Glover starts a new job as a home health care aide. And yes, she'll be getting to work on the bus. In Erie, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There really is bias at that level. And so women have to fight that.
Female CEOs, or more accurately, the lack thereof. But first, let's do the numbers. There you go. I should have bet money. I would have won. Dow Industrial is down 274 points. 1.25% closed at 21,750. The NASDAQ down 123 points, 1.9%, 62.21. S&P 500 down 38, 1.5%, ended at 24.30. Cisco Systems dropped 4% today after a worse-than-expected outlook for the current quarter was announced. NetApp weakened 6.7%. Walmart led retailers lower, dropped 1.5%. Macy's swung down about 2.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury notes fell to 2.18%. All that stock money had to go somewhere, right? You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There have been two dirty words in the American financial lexicon the past year or so, Wells and Fargo. But the scandal-besieged bank seems to be cleaning up its act. It's replacing 3 of 15 board members, including the chairman, Stephen Sanger, is going to step down at the end of the year. Current vice chair, Elizabeth Duke, is going to take his place. We sent Marketplace's Ryan Kailath to find out whether this is actual change or something else.
The first question goes to Cornell Law professor Robert Hockett. Why exactly is Wells Fargo replacing board members?
Was it the cross-selling scandal, the life insurance scandal, the auto insurance scandal, or was it the lawsuit alleging that Wells Fargo ripped off small businesses on credit card transactions?
Well, the short answer is all of the above. The slightly longer-winded answer is that so many of these have come to light after the last shakeup.
You remember Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf stepped down last year after the first of its recent scandals, creating fake accounts for clients without their knowledge. After that, Hockett says the bank hoped its detractors were appeased.
Of course, since then, more of these scandals have come to light, and they have to roll even more heads.
Hockett says, though, that elevating Elizabeth Duke to chairwoman is a significant move, not just a symbolic one. Jeremy Kress of the University of Michigan Law School worked with Duke as a bank regulator at the Federal Reserve. He says her experience could help Wells get its compliance issues in line.
I think the bigger question is why people like Stephen Sanger were allowed to keep their jobs as long as they did.
Kress isn't the only one ascribing blame to the outgoing chairman. Senator Elizabeth Warren has called for the Fed to replace all 12 board members who were at Wells Fargo during the fake account scandal. In a statement yesterday, the senator said, quote, "Letting a few board members retire early and shuffling around current board members simply doesn't cut it." In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
We're going to take a couple of minutes here to talk CEOs, nothing to do with the recent troubles the president's been having with them. We're going to talk about the number of women who aren't getting top jobs in corporate America, because honestly, how have we not figured this out yet? Julie Creswell is with The New York Times. Jenna McGregor is a columnist at The Washington Post. They've both written about women in the C-suites. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Julie, let's start with you and give me a survey, would you, of where the state of play with female CEOs in some of the biggest companies in this economy. Where do we stand?
It's totally depressing. Female CEOs make up about 5% of management or the top spots at Fortune 500 companies. Man. And that's up from a few years ago. A decade ago or so, it was about 2%. But you're still talking a very small percentage of women running large corporations.
And we should point out here, Jenna, that in the past weeks and months, many female CEOs have departed, whether by choice or not.
We've lost a couple, Irene Rosenfeld at Mondelez and Sherry McCoy at Avon. I mean, I remember the Fortune 500 list came out recently and we had a headline that was like, you know, the number of female CEOs comes up to a all-time high of 32. And so the numbers can be at a high, but still be pretty low.
The catch, though, Julie, is that when you do look at the numbers, and I'm talking performance numbers here of companies with female CEOs, they generally do pretty good. And yet more women aren't getting these jobs.
That's right. And I think Jenna's written about this a bit more than I have. But that's exactly right. Is there's the studies out there that show that women as CEOs do tend to outperform men.
Yeah, there was a recent study that just came out last week from an investment firm actually in Scandinavia, who looked at companies globally, and over about an 8-year period, the annualized return of companies led by women was 25%, whereas for the broader market, it was 11%. And the question is why?
Yeah, well, so Jenna, let's answer that, right? What gives?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of speculation about what it might be, but there's kind of a chicken or the egg thing. Is a company that is big and performing well more likely to have better governance and more diversity, or are the women leading to the better performance?
Yeah. Is it possible, Julie, that women are just better managers, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot going on. Some of it's very company specific. I think there's obviously a lot of challenges still, though, in various industries with what you see happening right now in Silicon Valley, for instance, with the culture around mentoring diversity women that we have large tech companies like Google and Uber that are struggling right now with the role of women in the workplace. It's a much bigger question even than how this gets to women CEOs.
And yeah, Jenna, the headline about Uber was search for new female CEO at Uber leads to three men. And this is a company that is screaming for help with its issues with women.
It's apparent that maybe women didn't want that job. I don't know. It speaks to a phenomenon that's much broader, that women seem to receive a preponderance of jobs that are difficult, that are, you know, the company's in a turnaround strategy. There's a name for this known as the glass cliff, that, you know, it's a difficult, precarious position that women are often entrusted with.
And then I think that same research also shows that the women that do wind up in these companies that are turnaround companies or troubled companies also therefore tend to lack the support by the board that they are needed to make the changes and tend to have shorter tenures than men in similar turnaround or fix-it positions. So it's a catch-22 from women when they end up sometimes in these turnaround jobs.
Yeah, the name that comes to mind, Julie, is Marissa Mayer at Yahoo, right? They went through a raft of CEOs before that thing finally went under.
For sure, including I think there was a couple. There was another female CEO,
right,
Carol Bartz.
Yeah.
So I mean, yeah.
And yet, Marissa Mayer will be remembered as the CEO who undid Yahoo, right? That's going to be the first line of whatever remembrance of her is eventually published.
For sure.
So, you know, Jenna, you used to hear Silicon Valley blame the pipeline, right, for why there aren't or weren't more female engineers or engineers of color. Is that a factor, you think, in why there aren't more female CEOs?
I think that does play a role and is a factor to some extent. But one of Julie's colleagues wrote a really great story recently where she talked to one of the heads of one of the biggest executive search firms who says there really is bias at that level. Once you get to that level, there is a crowding out and so much competition for that top job. And so women have to fight that at that
at that top level.
And men fundamentally have to get over themselves.
That would be good.
I mean, right? That, you know, that's what it is.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, you two.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Julie Creswell with the New York Times, Jenna McGregor at the Washington Post. We talked, obviously, for a good while longer than what you heard there. We're going to put the rest of it on our Corner Office podcast. Check it out. Final note on the way out today, a little bit of rumor, a little bit of insight about the markets, this economy, and the Trump administration. There was a rumor today, later denied, that Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council, who is Jewish, was thinking about resigning after the president's press conference on Tuesday. Cohn, if you remember, was standing with the president when Trump said what he said. That rumor and speculation that once Cohn left, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin might leave, maybe Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross as well, that all started stocks on their way downhill this morning and gave the bond market a quick spasm as well. Again, the rumor was denied anonymously by a White House official, but here's the insight. If Cohn and or Mnuchin and or Ross leave, the chief domestic policy advisors to the president of the United States would be National Trade Council head Peter Navarro, senior advisor Stephen Miller, and chief strategist Steve Bannon, who we talked about at the beginning of the program, all of whom are strong advocates of muscular economic nationalism, tariffs and trade wars, and all that that implies. Wall Street today, a mess for the aforementioned reasons. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. He extended, so he's going to be around for a while. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.